welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News, online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. This is the part of the show, Democracy in Action. We cruise the internet, we find out what you're emailing, what you're viewing, what you're commenting on, what you're blogging. It's the most. Ian, all right, Ian, your story this morning, you asked us all to wait until the segment.
Yes.
To get involved or to do any research. So
we're going to have a little quiz.
Okay.
I hope nobody cheated. There was a most popular on CNN.com that this Florida anthropologist using fossils, 50,000-year-old fossils from France, had modeled the Neanderthal vocal tract to get a sense for what Neanderthals sounded like when they spoke. And he built a computer synthesizer which basically made Neanderthal sound. But I thought first we would all try and imagine what we thought Neanderthals sounded like. So would anyone like to guess what a Neanderthal sounds like?
What do I think a Neanderthal sounds like?
Because I thought it was kind of like Cookie
boyfriend.
Monster. Okay.
I have one.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Your world frightens and confuses me because I'm an unfrozen caveman lawyer.
Wow.
I think it sounds like a really drunk guy.
What do you, can I hear an imitation?
Oh, we're supposed to do imitations.
That's what I'm hoping
oh,
for.
Oh, how about Ewok? Like,
I think it's going to be totally underwhelming. It's just going to be like, hey, how's it going? I'm a Neanderthal.
I think it sounds like,
That's kind of what I thought.
me want kill.
Here it is. A Neanderthal saying the letter E.
What?
That's a Neanderthal. Let's hear it again one more time.
That's,
ladies and gentlemen, the Neanderthal carrying clubs around. They were all like,
worst science experiment ever.
Sounds like a monosyllabic beaker.
So this anthropologist is going to try and reconstruct a sentence with his computer model. So
that'll be really
interesting.
I'm going
to stay tuned to that.
Yeah.
Beaker with multisyllabic?
Dan, what do you have?
Hey, guys, I got a most emailed here from Yahoo News. Pentagon Institute calls Iraq war, quote, a major debacle with outcome, quote, in doubt. And this report comes from the National Defense University, which is the Pentagon's premier military educational institute. And they have some strong words in this report that just came out yesterday about the Iraq war, which sort of counter some of the more optimistic predictions coming out of the administration. And they say the war is it's a major debacle. That's the headline, quote, the outcome's in doubt. It should be said that most of this report was prepared before some recent improvements in the security situation there, but not an optimistic report from the National Defense University.
Breaking news: the war is not going well.
Right,
debacle. Not an optimistic word.
No.
True.
Tricia McKinney.
Yes, I have number 5 this morning on Google Trends was the name Aliza Schwartz, and it turns out she's a Yale University art student who was reported on yesterday in the Yale Daily News student newspaper saying that she had done this art piece that involved her artificially inseminating herself and then inducing abortion, and she was going to use the result to make an art project. Well, of course, this caused a lot of outrage. And then later she was confronted by Yale University officials and reportedly admitted to them that the whole thing was an elaborate performance art project. So apparently she was never pregnant. She never induced an abortion. She was planning to do an art project and project video of herself performing one of these procedures. And I don't know if that's even going to happen anymore. So there you go.
I got no words for that. Story. I got no comment.
So what did you say this morning?
Well, okay. I said I hate performance art. If that's performance art, then I hate performance art.
It's one of those things that gets people who don't like performance art to really, really... gives them some ammunition, I have to say.
Hurry. Someone who does performance art that I like, do something I like.
Rachel, what do you have?
I have a sad story. One of the founding members of the E Street Band has passed away. Danny Federici, he was the longtime keyboard player for Bruce Springsteen. He had battled melanoma for 3 years, and he died recently in New York, succumbing to that cancer. And it was actually, according to this report, it was Federici who invited Springsteen to join their band many, many years ago.
Dan Pashman, you're the assist.
You're the expert.
That's certainly a good move by Dan Federici, I think. But yeah, it is unfortunate. He actually left the band a few months ago to deal with his treatment full time, and obviously it had a sad ending. But he joined the band on tour for a surprise visit back on March 20th in Indianapolis. Mm-hmm. To play a song called Sandy, which is a kind of obscure fan favorite Bruce song, but it features Dan Federici on the accordion, and that's actually been posted on Bruce's website. So we have a clip of Dan Federici's last performance with the E Street Band.
Remember Dan Federici of the E Street Band today.
We've got another rock band in the most category. A Yahoo Buzz, some of the most searched terms. Jane's Addiction was on the list today. And the reason is that the four original members of Jane's Addiction will reunite for an award. Now, some of the other members had reunited in the past. There was one holdout, the bass player, Eric Avery, had not played with these guys since 1991. He refused to get back with the band. Remember Flea from the Red Hot Chili Peppers was in there for a while?
Right.
Well, what would make him join the band again? They're getting an award from NME, the British news magazine, music magazine. It's going to be in L.A. on April 23rd, and the award they're getting is the Godlike Genius Award.
Oh, for
So it's like, fun.
So I think that would help if you deify
me and put me in Mensa. That'll show up.
First, they offered him the Genius Award. He's like, nope, I'm not coming.
Not coming back.
All right, Godlike Genius Award.
They're getting it for their contribution for songs like this.
Classic.
Yes.
Yeah, it's from Ritual de la Habitual and Nothing Shocking in 1988. Those are the two albums they cited for their godlike genius awards. So they'll be back on stage.
That's a stretch.
I like them.
I've always really liked Jane's Addiction, but that's a title. Matt, what do you have?
I have one of the most emailed stories at NPR right now. It's taking the temperature of a Weather Channel fan. Did you guys know that the channel has 85 million viewers a month?
Oh, yeah. Weather Channel is huge.
My mom, like, nonstop.
My mom, too.
Oh, really? It's a maternal thing.
It's huge. It has, obviously, groupies, people who just love the Weather Channel. Did you know Bob Garfield of On the Media was a huge Weather Channel fan? I don't know if he still is, but he did a piece a couple years ago on All Things Considered. Yeah. Anyway, so reporter Hannah Yaffe-Walt did this report about the Weather Channel's biggest fans.
I want to help you see what I'm seeing right here in front of me. A well-pillowed couch, a television, a middle-aged man, and he's in this state. It's hard to describe. Okay, so you know how when a toddler who's not really been exposed to TV sees one and his eyes kind of lock, his mouth and his little shoulders, everything just gets really still? That's Doug Olson, the moment this channel flickers to life.
Here's our local Doppler radar.
I point out to Olson that he appears to be transfixed.
The Weather Channel is a fascinating station.
Olson teaches sixth grade on Bainbridge Island. It's across Puget Sound from Seattle. He's got a Mr. Rogers personality and fashion sense. And he's a weather fanatic. The lows, the highs, the wind chills, the records. The guy can't get enough.
I'm not addicted to weather, but I can watch it a lot. I can watch them cycle through all the national weather once, twice, three times.
So Olson always knows where the hottest and coldest places in the country are, the most rainfall, the strongest winds, and he loves it when his favorite reporters take him to the extreme weather.
I've sometimes watched a couple of them slip and fall when they're trying to talk and they're just pouring down rain and the wind and everything else, but you can feel the weather when you watch that kind of a program like that.
Olson's grandfather was weather crazy too. He took temperature measurements on his northern Idaho farm for decades. So as soon as Olson could get together enough money, he set up his own weather station. It sits on the roof of his school and computes new data every second. And at the end of the year, he unveils it, the average annual temperature.
We've had many years that varied less than 1/10 of a degree. And then we had one year about 5 years ago, it was 4 degrees higher. It was just stunning. And I just realized I know something nobody else knows.
The Weather Channel may be able to offer reports on his region, but only Olson has accurate weather information for his exact location. And that's pretty valuable. City engineers call him often for records and averages, so do realtors. And one time there was a car accident and one driver claimed he skidded on ice, and the police actually called Olson to find out if it was possible that there was ice in that spot on that day. Okay, but on top of all of that, Olson's weather station actually sees the partly sunny light of day every single morning. Move over, Weather Channel, and make room for the Sakai Intermediate School weather broadcast.
Okay, in 5, 4, 3.
Olson created his own mini weather channel at his school. His data, his sixth grade students, in kid-friendly weather casting characters.
Hi, I'm Spider-Man.
And I'm Robin. It's only rained 3/19 of an inch this month. I wonder if we'll double that.
Wow, the low last night was 33 degrees.
Well, now, I do need to step in here just to be clear, in case you're thinking Doug Olson is some weather-crazed guy who obsessively measures solar brightness and has his students perform the Weather Channel for him. He is all those things, but Olson is actually also an incredibly well-rounded guy, a fabulous teacher, a lovely husband. Normal, accomplished people have been obsessing over the weather long before the Weather Channel, and they've had the bug way worse. Like this one guy, he had to travel to Philadelphia for work, and he brought his weather equipment with him. That man, Thomas Jefferson. Just making sure that signing the Declaration of Independence didn't get in the way of his 50 years of weather recordings.
That's reporter Hannah Jaffe Waltz. Links to all the stories you heard on The Most are on our website, npr.org/Bryant Park.